Major Cochrane, Reel 11. We got to the point where you just captured Nebewa camp. One of the jobs you were put on, I believe, was burying the dead, and not a very pleasant task. Could you tell us about that?
That was the first time we'd come across this task, and it really was pretty disagreeable. Well, there were our own dead, we did have some to bury, but then it was essential to bury the Italian dead as well. I suppose one felt one couldn't, although it was perishing cold at night, it still was pretty warm in the middle of the day. I suppose though we hadn't seen them, there would have been carrion eating jackals and kites around. Clearly you could only do this sort of thing if the actual fighting had stopped. And since we were bundling the Italians who surrendered off, get them out of the way, I wasn't able to employ them as additional help in the burying job. It was a pretty, at that stage, it was a fairly disagreeable thing to be doing. They were, to put it really in horrible terms, they were fresh bodies, not rotting bodies, which we had to deal with later. But the thing I the Italians did have some very small tanks, several of these had been hit, either by anti-tank fire, and had caught and gone up in flames. And I took one look into a tank, knowing there must be somebody in it, and there was the remains of somebody. But I vetoed any attempt to try and get. I know I wouldn't do it, and therefore I wouldn't really tell any of the jocks.
With the Italians, were they just buried in mass graves, or would you attempt to record details of who was buried where?
No, we couldn't do that. What we did do is we didn't do mass graves. It was easier simply because all we had was our entrenching tools, our little shovels. A shallow trough, one by one in the sand. And then we did put sticks up, a couple of sticks across to mark the head of each grave. So eventually somebody, some authority, could come and bury them properly.
But what about British corpses?
They stayed, they were buried there too. Separately, so that you could tell. And very often with the British soldier, you stuck his bayonet in too.
Did you take their dog tags, American, but their ID tags?
And you put the, identity disc onto the handle of the bayonets that tied on. This was a pretty fatuous thing to do because if there weren't carrion coming to eat corpses, there certainly were odd Senussi wandering around. And if we'd stopped to think about it, when the battle was over, something like a bayonet would be a highly useful thing to pinch. There wasn't really time to think about that.
Now, the next thing was you moved on to Siliberani camp.
First of all, told that we had to be ready to repeat the operation on another camp, which was in fact the same camp that we had raided in October, 2 months earlier. But before we could ever get near it, the message came through that the Italians, they'd either abandoned it and retreated or they'd surrendered.
That was Mactila.
But then came a good example of didn't turn out to be a shambles, but it was pretty shambolic because Andy Anderson, our CEO, were still, if you like, on the way to Mactila or had been stopped going to Mactila. He suddenly got on the radio completely new orders, which were to attack Siliberani, which was originally just a little Arab fishing village on the shore, but had, when Graziani, with huge fanfare, had announced earlier on that he was invading Egypt, he had made that his main base. And Sidi Barani was, in fact, on the Egyptian side of the frontier from Libya. And there was no sort of time for the brigadier to have got his commanding officers together. No time for a proper order group by Andy for his company commanders. He just got hold of the first two to hand. David Douglas, our company commander, and the company commander of D Company, Don Company. And as David reported back, the orders were that Sidi Barani had to be captured, and if possible, before nightfall. It was now, I suppose, getting near noon. And that information about the enemy, the enemy's in some strength, in i.e., going to be more than the camps in the way of opposition, that our neighbouring brigade, the 5th Brigade, had attacked it in the morning. And the Argyles had very heavy casualties, and the attack had been a failure. We were to start now, and A Company would lead towards the village and the shore, and C Company would follow. Off you go. That was all the information that Andrew's orders he could give us. So we again took the trucks as far as we could. Then disembarked. A went off ahead of us. We started just after them. And then it was a large area. instead of the camp in the Baywa that we'd attacked, which was a fairly compact redoubt almost, with wire and fortifications around it, this was a very large area in which there were no formal defences in the shape of wire or ditches, though there was an anti-tank ditch at one point. Of course, two companies in this huge area soon got very scattered, and we really had lost touch with A, except we knew that A were moving along. We could hear odd shooting near the shore, and we were moving along roughly parallel to them, but inland a bit. And they presumably could hear our odd shooting. There were machine gun posts, and quite a few of them. These had to be attacked. In most cases, when you got near enough, but not too near, the people manning the machine gun post surrendered. Important to stress that before we got too near, because the same thing later at Kerem, the same thing in Italy. If a machine gunner is shooting at you and he doesn't put his hands up until you're absolutely on top of him, you don't accept his surrender anymore. So you've been so frightened by the machine gun fire, which has made you so angry, that you kill him. So if you're going to surrender in a machine gun post, do it in good time. Then you'll be all right. Well, they did. And then behind them, there were a whole lot of dugouts, more for comfort, I think, probably, than for any military purpose. And these were mostly unoccupied, but they had camouflage canvas coverings over the top. It was very difficult to see, in fact, whether they were successful camouflage. In one case, I fell, didn't realize I was running over the top of one of these things, and I fell right through the canvas up to my armpits. And just at the moment when Sergeant Aubrey flung a grenade in through the entranceway, and I came out of that hole in the canvas like a rocket just before the grenade went off. So this went on and on. As we took prisoners, we just sent them back, told them to make their own way back, and they could, if they wanted, have escaped, but there was no place to escape to, so they did all wander back. And eventually, with 15 platoon and a few other people from other platoons in the company, I reckoned I'd reached the end of where it was useful to go. The light was going, there seemed to be no further. We'd aimed our advance so far wherever we heard firing coming from machine guns or from light field guns, but there were no more guns firing, so we didn't know if there were any more enemy about, or even where, if there had been, where to go for them. But by this time, it was a real rather vexatious position for a very raw young officer, because I'd lost touch with A Company, I'd lost a good deal of touch with a good deal of my own Charlie Company, my platoon was still together. So I, the only thing to do I thought was to sort of try and go back, swing round a bit, and make my way to the rear, where presumably I'd find Battalion HQ somewhere. And we came to a deep anti-tank ditch, very helpful, because the next person from the battalion I could see was C Company's Company Sergeant Major, CSM Watty Reed. He was a marvellous man, and I think 20 years service, superb CSM. Anyhow, he and about three jocks had an enormous quantity of prisoners under their wing. Turned out later 2,800 of them. The anti-tank ditch was handy, because by now the moon was up and we could get all the prisoners into there. And I left Watty with his three or four chaps from Company HQ that he was shepherding these people with, left the rest of the platoon with him, took one job with me, and went off to try and find where the rest of the Cameron Highlanders were. I thought Battalion HQ might be in Sidibarani village. It was the only place with any sort of building, so I could find nobody there. I wandered around a bit, and by this time, really the cold had set in, and we were still in our just khaki shorts and shirts with a jersey. That was the only thing to keep the cold off, and it really was bloody cold. I came across the Argyles headquarters and the CO. I told him who I was, and I had no idea where I was. I knew where I was trying to get to, my battalion HQ report. He said, I know where they are, but my teeth were chattering so much with the cold that somehow or other he did produce a whiskey bottle and gave me a huge dram of whiskey. And behind him I could see they'd had a big tent up, and their MO was still operating on soldiers who'd been wounded in the attack they'd made that morning. So I pushed on again, and eventually did find Battalion HQ by chance. They told me where the rest of Charlie Company now was, with David Douglas. I told them where Watty Reed, his army of prisoners, was, and could they arrange for somebody to go and relieve Watty and take over the prisoners. Then I was given orders by the adjutant, Tony Noble, for the following day, that at first light, Charlie Company had to be on the move, and we had to go somewhere. It was eventually countermanded, but it was thought there might still be another camp that had not yet surrendered. So I got back to Company HQ. It was a good lesson to me for later on. I found David Douglas. So everybody was absolutely exhausted, out for the count, apart from one, a couple of sentries. Found David and pulled him hard by the boot, and he sat up. And I told him, you know, I was back, that I hoped the platoon would be back too in a very short time, but that we had these orders. And I passed them on to him, and he asked me a couple of questions, and Wenzel nodded his head and went back on his, not his pillow, but on his folded up cardigan. And I stretched out and fell asleep. But it turned out that he'd never woken up at all. This was, he'd done as an absolute automaton. So, of course, in the morning, at first light, where the Charlie Company sound asleep, lying around the countryside. So I was a black mark for Second Lieutenant Cochran. But obviously it sounded as though I'd been too idle ever to pass on the orders. However, those who just had to bite on the bullet. Then, as far as the battalion was concerned, this possible attack on this next day was called off, and we were told that we're going to go back to our old positions at the Bagouche box, back to Gorola. Fine. Except that it was decided by the CO to get the kit away first, all the heavy stuff, and then dump all that back at Gorola, and then return and pick up the battalion. And surprisingly, in view of my lapse, I was told by the adjutant to take charge of the convoy vehicles. It was quite a long way. I mean, it took us about 2.5 days to get back. It was fairly slow going cross country. And apart from one awful moment when there was a blinding storm blew up, can see a blinding dust storm in which we crossed the one tarmac road that existed in the whole of that part of the world, from Mersey Matruh down inland to Siwa Oasis. And half the drivers, so taken aback at seeing a bit of tarmac, they whizzed off down this road in one direction. So when the dust storm abated, I had to wind them up and then get back to our old positions.
You were attacked by Italian aircraft, I believe.
Yeah, we were shot. We had seen no Italian aircraft in the attacks on the camp or on Sidi Lerami. But these were fighter planes, so we were a sort of emulation, I suppose, of what the Stukas had been doing, except they weren't dive bombers. It was a machine gun fire. Very disagreeable, actually, being in a truck with airplane shooting at you. It was much better to be out on the ground somehow. And we did have ACAT patrols, and we did have, at least on one truck, a Bren gun mounted on its anti-aircraft tripod with a gunner there. I'm sure he loosed off just for the hell of it, but to no avail. Then back again to take all the transport back, and we were able to, without the kit, pile everybody in and get back again to what seemed like home, our old original sanos in the desert, just the same places we were in, except this time they really rolled up a whole collection of water trucks. So more or less one per company instead of one per battalion. So as long as we had receptacles to put water in, we really could get cleaned up. We were absolutely filthy, of course. I forgot now how long we'd been away. I could work it out. But I suppose we'd been away running around doing all this, starting at the time when we'd originally been told we were just going to go and have an exercise in the desert. Before the balloon went up. I suppose it was a fortnight, something like this. The thing I remember most about it, in a way, I think, is the cold. The only mistake, I think, in the campaign, which was otherwise brilliant to organize, was the fact that the GHQ, they'd forgotten to pop the temperature drop to. And of course, everybody's greatcoats were all in Cairo in the battalion stores and in the Kazril Neil barracks. And all we could have done with those greatcoats.
Was it mainly at night or was it in the day?
No, just in the night. At the daytime, it warmed up slightly, right, sort of middle of the morning. And it was quite your shirt and shorts. With admittedly your khaki pullover on top, it was perfectly okay then. But you had nothing more to put on when night came down. It really was cold.
Now the next thing, you moved in December, you know, when you got back to Alex.
Mm. Yes. We had obviously, down at, I don't know what Andy knew, as far as the rest of us knew, it was all pretty vague, except to our great excitement, we were told very shortly that we were not staying at the Baghouz box, which was now thought, in fact, to be useless, since the advance had continued. By this time, Western Desert Force, as it was then called, was through out of Egypt and into Libya, and bowling along into Cyrenaica. Back to Alex, and we, as far as the battalion was concerned, they were put into a tented camp about 20 miles from Alex itself. Presently, I think it was called Amria. Still, no doubt, near the shore, and still on the one-track railway line that led all the way from Alex to Mersin-Matru, so that some stuff could have been sent down by rail, I suppose. But I was very lucky, because I was given 4 days' leave, and could shoot off to Cairo. So once again, hot baths, and visit to Gazela Club, and decent meals, and that was good fun, even if only 4 days. And when I got back to, there was another chap on leave with me from the battalion, and instead of flogging our way back in up the train to Alex and all the rest of it, and since we, even the second lieutenant, whatever our pay was there, we had been able to spend any of it for some time, we blew our cash on hiring a cab, a taxi, which drove us up to to Amria. And that was interesting, because it was for the very first time since that I had ever seen all the officers together. And when you visited the sergeants' mess, there were all the sergeants together, the sergeants from other companies, and company sergeant majors and quartermasters that you'd never set eyes on. In some cases, one had talked in the dark very often. Certainly, it was the first time I'd ever sort of exchanged, had conversations with the other company commanders, or the second in command, Colonel Duncan, or even Andy, our colonel.
Now, what was the officer's mess like?
Well, just a tent. I mean, and the food was precisely what the jocks were having. We all knew that this was just a temporary thing before another move, so there was no point in from the battalion stores in Cairo, where there was, I never saw it, it was never used, of course, things like the regimental silver and all the, you know, the regimental colours and everything like that. That was all in store and stayed in store. But you could at least, and this was very agreeable, I mean, both in the wet canteen and in the corporal's mess, the sergeant's mess, the officer's mess, drink was still fairly short supply, but at least you could get a drink, and very welcome it was too. And the I'd had my 4 days' leave, so I was on duty in the camp, but other officers and the soldiers in turn, in sort of by company more or less, in buses were taken into Alex, and there were some fairly wild scenes, I think, nothing too obstreperous, but all the jocks had plenty of pay, and Alex had plenty of bars and cafes and cinemas and shops. If people wanted to buy something, you had a chance of buying it.
How well did they behave themselves, would you say?
I thought they behaved themselves as expected. I mean, they got tight, but very few cases of being what you might call ugly drunk, ugly fool. Mostly it was just they'd quietly sipped away till they were in a state of bare consciousness, but were quietly just sitting up, propping up a wall. However, they did amuse themselves by running around the main square where the buses were lined up to take them back. Buses sounds very comfortable. It was more like three tonner coaches. And, shouting to the RSM, well, you cannot catch me, Godley, you cannot catch me. A few were shoved into the military police, got hold of a few. But there was no there was nothing riotous. And equally, it's worth noting, I think, there was nothing like anti-Egyptian activity. People weren't throwing bottles at gypos, as they were called. I suppose that partly was because all these chaps had been soldiering in India, and a native population was something to respect, and not at least in a good unit, not to muck about with.
How did you feel about the Egyptians you met, or Arabs?
Well, I met them. I don't think I ever met any. I talked to one or two about. Obviously in Alexandria, I'll talk about Alexandria, about Cleopatra, about the great pharaohs, you know, whereabouts had it been. And there were only people one met, if you like, sitting having a coffee at a cafe, and one got into conversation. But most of the Egyptians one met were people in serving one in pubs and bars and restaurants. So we didn't. If you'd been stationed in Alex or Cairo, and if you had cared to, you could have met, I think, sure. Well, I do know from people who were in that position, some exceedingly interesting erudite Egyptians, scholars of one sort or another, quite well from professional.
What about Christmas celebrations?
Well, I mean, there wasn't any really.
Did they have the traditional things? I mean, in the army, so the officers serving the men.
This is de rigueur. You had to attend, as bad for the digestion, because you had to attend your own companies. This was very important, Christmas dinner. And get them off to a flying start.
And would you and the NCO serve them?
Yes, that is correct. Yes, yes. Mind you, we had to, since Charlie Company only had two officers, they'd have had a damn long wait if nobody else had lent a hand. Then the officers en masse had, when this was over, so to speak, well, it wasn't so much another lunch in the sergeant's mess. It was really a kind of buffet supper with drinks. And, of course, the object of the sergeant's mess was to make quite sure that certainly any junior officer would be absolutely paralytic. But you had to be pretty careful about that. I think the corporal's mess also but probably joined in that, having had their Christmas dinner with their companies.
How did you do? Did you get drunk?
I think I've only been tight, really tight, about three times in my life, and that was certainly one of them. Somebody, I don't know who it was, I suspect it was my adored Sergeant Horbury, got me back to the tent I was in, shared with a few other people. But it was again, it was okay. Nobody was ugly fool. People were just quietly drunk.
Ugly fool means sort of the way they behaved. They weren't violent or aggressive.
Yes, being aggressive. Yes, picking a fight with somebody. You know.
And there was none of that.
No. I imagine, not that I was aware of, but ever saw,